Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why do we sleep? What is its purpose? And what actually happens during sleep? But first, unprecedented times in the USA. Is the country facing an existential crisis? And if so, what might affect the outcome? With us are three experts. Lewis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of On Constitutional Disobedience, Silence and Freedom, Constitutional Law, Equal Protection of the Laws, and Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Sanford Levinson is chair in law at the University of Texas Law School and a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Mark Peterson also joins us. He's a professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA. His books include Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill, From Eisenhower to Reagan, Institutions of American Democracy, The Executive Branch, and Institutions of American Democracy, A Republic Divided. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you, two of you returning. Mark, I thought we should let you know that you're joining a conversation that began last week about this president, this Congress, the FBI, the special investigation, and to some extent, the Supreme Court. And last week, we talked about how the current situation fits within U.S. history. We talked about the rule of law, the constitutional arrangements. So now we want you to give us some insight as a scholar of institutions about the kind of larger political context. Perhaps the best place to start is the partisan element. We don't have a divided government, which we often have, where parties govern different branches. That requires compromise and negotiation. How often have we seen what we've got today with one party running essentially all the branches?
It's not rare, but it's also not the usual circumstance. In fact, most of the years in the recent presidencies have been a divided government of one kind or another. What's also unusual is this is a unified government under the Republican Party. It's only the third time since the Great Depression that Republicans have had unified government, and they've never had it by a very strong hold. The last two times, they only had 50 seats in the Senate, so their majority was formed by the vice president. This majority that they have in the House is considerably larger than the majority they've had in the two previous circumstances. So this, in some senses, was the greatest window of opportunity for the Republicans to leverage unified government and pull the agenda the direction that they wanted to. But obviously, it's with pretty narrow majorities, and they've had to recognize that, particularly in the Senate, it's hard to hold together that majority. It's impossible to get to a filibuster-proof majority. So they've had to maneuver through all the technical and arcane rules of reconciliation in order to try to move their most significant agenda items. And of course, the one place where they succeeded is in the tax cuts and jobs bill, which has a lot of policy problems to it as they've tried to weave together their own internal differences.
Yeah, and it seems that they're really unafraid to use all of these tactics now. They're really emboldened in some way to the degree that it looks like there's this big bully in the room all the time. How do you assess this in light of American politics? Is this completely unprecedented, or is there something we can look to?
It's not unprecedented, but it is taking past patterns to an extreme. And again, part of it is, I think, that for many Republicans like Paul Ryan, he has spent a lifetime, or at least an adult lifetime, imagining an opportunity like this, and he's not going to squander it. So he's been able within himself to make a number of compromises in order to stick to that agenda. The other thing that is unusual is we've reached the peak in the modern era of partisan polarization, of ideological difference between the two parties and ideological consistency in each of the parties. So that has really elevated the tribal element of this confrontation. And this kind of polarization just simply does not work well in a separation of power system like ours, where even when there's unified government, there are opportunities for the minority within the majority party or the opposing party to use various levers to try to slow things down or make the whole process much more complicated. So the one irony I want to underscore is if you go back to 2009 or 2010, and you replay the speeches that now Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made about how problematic it is to enact legislation on the basis of only one party's support, and how important it would be to slow down the process and get to a bipartisan deliberation, I think you'd find yourself bent over laughing, comparing that to how he has articulated the situation today and how he's tried to maneuver along with Speaker Ryan through the particular congressional arrangements they have today.
Do you think this is purely partisan? Is this just a Faustian deal, or is there another explanation?
It depends on what the it is there. I think there for many of the Republicans, and particularly their leaders, this they recognize. The leaders have past experience. Most of the Republicans in the House, for instance, have never served with a Republican Congress and a Republican president. So this is the first time they've had to govern. And they're used to being an ideological opposition. Well, now they are governing, and now they also know this is a rare window to try to really move what is a fairly conservative agenda. This is the most conservative Republican Party that has been in the House in the post-war period. So just as a matter from their point of view of pure principle, you seize the moment and move this legislation through. This is the one time to take on the New Deal, the New Frontier, and the Great Society.
Sandy Levinson, what would you add to this?
Well, I certainly agree with the basic analysis. I think that the one problem is the assumption that divided government actually works. That I think what divided government, which we get courtesy of a U.S. Constitution that I continue not to like, is that it brings about gridlock. It generates an incentive for people like Mitch McConnell altogether rationally to say that he will do nothing to make Barack Obama look like a success, because in our political system, that redounds to the benefit of the president. And there's no reason to expect Mitch McConnell, in effect, to collaborate with Barack Obama to make him reelectable in 2012. As it happens, he failed in his quest, but that's not to say that he was behaving irrationally. So my view is that we're in the pickle we are in the United States because there's a deep disconnect between the party system we have, which, as Mark Peterson says, is remarkably polarized, the most since the pre-Civil War era. But that's layered on top of a political system that was designed by people who basically hated the very idea of political parties and designed a system that could work if and only if we had selfless leaders who regularly put country above faction. This was Madison's great worry. Well, it hasn't worked out that way. And this is one reason why I think countries with parliamentary systems, though they have their own problems, are marginally speaking in better shape than the American system is.
Mike Seidman.
So I agree with most of what's been said. Let me just add a few quick points. First, I think Mark has actually somewhat understated the extent of one-party control we have now, because it's not just that the Republicans control both houses of Congress and control the White House. They also control the Supreme Court, and people like to pretend that the Supreme Court is apolitical and that party affiliation doesn't matter. I understand why people like to pretend that, but it's not true. And the fact is that the Republicans control the Supreme Court. On top of that, they also control the majority of state legislatures. Mark probably knows the figure. I don't know it off the top of my head, but in a surprisingly large number of states, they control both houses of the legislature and the governorship. So there is really something close to unprecedented one-party control, certainly not something that we've had all that often in American history. So that's the first point. The second point is, what's really remarkable is that in spite of that overwhelming party control, and in spite of the fact that the Republican Party is much more unified than political parties used to be, they're having a very big problem getting anything done at all. And I think that is a real indication of just how many checks there are in the American system, how many veto gates there are, how hard it is to get the government machinery moving. And now, I happen to be an opponent of the Trump administration, so on particular situation we're in now, I think that's probably a good thing. But if I can step away from that a little, I think it is a problematic feature of the American system. And then just the last point I want to make, which I think is pretty obvious, all these problems of party division and so on and polarization would exist in any event, but it's all just greatly exacerbated by the existence and personality of our president, who just makes everything, the divisions and the vituperativeness and the willingness to use any means available, it makes all of that much worse.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the legal and political factors that will shape the Trump presidency. Yeah, there are a couple of questions that come up. One is, since when did it become a conservative value to sort of sidestep the rule of law? You would hear them advocate in other circumstances. And that's sort of a rhetorical question. We don't really have to answer that. I suppose where I would like to go is something that Mike Seidman started to say last week. Last week, he made a very provocative and powerful statement about 2018 going down as historical in terms of defining the USA and whether or not it even continues as a country. I thought it was so powerful, I led with it. There have been articles since then, for example, in the Washington Post, arguing that if you want to see the country that Donald Trump is turning the USA into, look to Turkey. So let's look at this as a possibility, given our institutions, given our values and our Constitution itself. Mark Peterson, is that really possible?
There's a part of me that deeply holds on to the hope and the view that that isn't actually possible. But this is the first time, frankly, I think, in my professional life where the question could be even posed in a serious way. Now, there are a lot of things that separate us from Turkey. We have a much longer historical tradition as an evolving democratic society with all the institutions, both government and civic, that go along with that. We have a system that makes it very hard to change the constitutional arrangements of power, which I think Sandy Levinson probably is very frustrated with, as are many people, given what we have seen. But it also means that you cannot have a parallel situation in the United States where it would be easy for President Trump and his allies to accumulate even more constitutional power than they have right now. We do have enormous number of checks. And one of the things about studying these institutions as a political scientist is a recognition that sometimes those checks are enormously frustrating when there are really very good things that one might view government ought to be able to do and should do. And we are decades, you might say, behind where other democratic societies are on those fronts. And at the same time, there is nothing about an electoral system that has a requirement for the presidency or a prime minister or any other role that simply gives an age requirement and a citizen requirement that specifies whoever gets elected in that system is going to be thoughtful, rational, informed, knowledgeable, and have a reasonably healthily contained ego. And so we have to grapple with a system in which we've got this particularly unusual president. And right now, we would be in a very different circumstance if, in fact, under a parliamentary system, we had arrived at this kind of partisan polarization and had this kind of leadership in place.
Sandy Levinson.
I would say a couple of things. I don't think Turkey is the right analogy, in part because Turkey is overwhelmingly Muslim with a significant secular elite. We're not overwhelmingly anything. I mean, one of the things that is so completely striking about the United States now, as opposed to the United States that I grew up in 60 years ago, is that Christians are becoming less and less dominant within American society. When I was growing up, one spoke normally and regularly of governance by the WASP elites. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants were taken basically as the hegemonic powers, and there were, you know, some minorities, but it was basically a WASP country. We don't live in that country anymore. I don't know what the right analogy would be, but I do think it's a problem with thinking about Turkey. But that's simply one point. A second point I want to make is that Mark is absolutely correct that there are all sorts of limits with regard to presidents achieving a domestic agenda. If Hillary Clinton had been elected and we were having this discussion right now, the main topic of conversation would be her inability to get anything whatsoever done domestically except by pushing executive power to the hilt. But I think this correct observation misses the point that since World War II, we have created a conception of the commander-in-chief power that is frighteningly dictatorial. I would actually trace this back in some ways by myth and symbol to John F. Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis, where I tend to be an outlier and not an admirer of Kennedy. But I do think that there are some honorable exceptions, but there is an astonishingly broad consensus that presidents have basically unilateral power to declare war and unilateral power to rip up treaties and to create havoc in the world. And I think that the fundamental fear of Donald Trump, what keeps people up at night, is what he can do in the realm of foreign policy. And here, I think there are lots and lots of other countries around the world that have a more subtle and nuanced view of what we would call the commander-in-chief power. A third thing, while I've got your attention, I'd be particularly interested in hearing Mark's response since he lives in California. I'm one of those people who takes secession seriously, certainly as an intellectual idea, but I'm also truly intrigued by whether he believes there's any possibility that what I sometimes call Pacifica could take on a certain political reality. There was an article in the New York Times just about 10 days ago whose major point was that California, with its roughly 40 million people, sixth largest freestanding economy in the world, is really, in certain important senses, a different country from the rest of the United States. Does he believe that there's any possibility that the secessionist sentiment one sometimes reads of in California would become a real political movement?
Mark, would you like to respond to that?
Sure, I will. And Sandy, I may disappoint you, but I think particularly living out here, it would be almost unimaginable for that to be realized. People in California have very strong California feelings. And certainly I talk about the state of California as being a bulwark in opposition to where Washington is right now with the Trump administration and the way Congress is going with Trump. But I think that is much greater sense of California as a point of leverage, as a, to borrow from Ronald Reagan, the shining city on a hill that is creating the lodestar for where we can direct attention in the post-Trump era. And in the meantime, do some serious things like actually have impact on climate change policy because we are so large and because we are willing to take such bold strides in that policy direction. Frankly, I don't hear on a day-to-day basis anybody anywhere talking about secession. It's a very small fringe within California, and Pacifica, of course, would include Oregon and Washington. And I can't imagine any circumstance in which that would actually play out in that direction.
Okay, so let's go back a step to this question about authoritarianism again and where we're going based upon Mike Seidman's last week's assertion. Where could it go, Mike Seidman?
Let me lead into that by just saying something about Mark's last comments, and I'm sure he's right, but it also does have to be said, we live in an era of remarkable political uncertainty where everything seems to be up for grabs and where I don't think anybody has a clear idea where we will be a decade or two decades from now. And so things that are just politically inconceivable now, I could imagine being on the table 10 years from now. I don't think anybody knows. Now, having said that, I'm not claiming that California is going to secede or that we are going to become a authoritarian country. I just said, I don't think anybody really knows, but I do think that it is a possibility and that this year is going to be crucial in figuring out how real a possibility it is. In that regard, there's one aspect of the analogy to Hungary and Poland, as well as Turkey, that I think is really disturbing. And that is, so it is true the United States has a long constitutional tradition, but what happened in those countries was done through constitutional means. So it's not like there were massive constitutional violations. What's happened instead is that a determined radical group of people gained control of the levers of power and used the Constitution to entrench themselves and to prevent meaningful democratic opposition. And the irony is, at this point in Hungary in particular, what would be required to get rid of these people would be constitutional violation of some kind, because the Constitution's been amended through constitutional processes in ways that entrenched the people who are in power now. Now, could that happen in the United States? So here is the situation we are in. I believe that sometime within the next year, it's highly possible that Robert Mueller will get too close to President Trump for his comfort and that he will fire him, get rid of him. And at that point, we are going to see whether the Republicans in Congress are willing to stand up to the president and do something about it. They may and they may not. If they don't, and if Trump and the Republicans get away with this, then I think there are lots of possibilities that are off the table now that would be on the table for them. And I could easily imagine the United States becoming a very different country from the country it is now. If they do stand up, or if they're defeated massively in the election in 2018, then there are different possibilities that I could see. But I really do think that as we speak now, there is no one who knows what's actually going to happen, and it is very frightening.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. This is part one of a two-part series. Tune in next week to hear part two. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. He is the author of On Constitutional Disobedience, Silence and Freedom, Constitutional Law, Equal Protection of the Laws, and Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Sanford Levinson is chair in law at the University of Texas Law School and a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Mark Peterson is a professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA. His books include Legislating Together, The White House and Capitol Hill, From Eisenhower to Reagan, Institutions of American Democracy, The Executive Branch, and Institutions of American Democracy, A Republic Divided. When we come back, why do we sleep? What is its purpose? And what actually happens during sleep? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Scientists are still trying to understand the mysteries of our slumber. With us are two experts who study the science of sleep. Marcos Frank is professor and chair at the Department of Biomedical Sciences at Washington State University, Spokane. He's the author of The Mystery of Sleep Function, The Role of Sleep in Memory Consolidation and Brain Plasticity, Dream or Reality. Graham Deering also joins us. He's a professor of cell biology and physiology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the co-author of Homer 1A Drives Homeostatic Scaling Down Vexatory Synapses During Sleep. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. I thought perhaps we should start with the very basics. What do we know about the purpose of sleep? Graham Deering, why don't you start us with what you have found?
Well, it's possibly a long answer, and I think we don't know the whole answer. But from my point of view, I've been focusing on learning and memory, and I think we can definitely say that sleep plays a very essential role in our ability to form memories and to continue to learn.
And how does that actually happen? What is the process in which sleep gives us this?
There are a few competing ideas, but one kind of emerging theme is that different parts of the brain are devoted to computing different types of information while we're awake. And it's only when you go offline, unconscious, that these different parts of the brain are actually able to stop what they're busy doing during the day and communicate with each other and consolidate memories. And you can imagine lots of memories might have many different kinds of components, visual components, emotional components, motor components. And it's really this time of sleep when all of these pieces can come together and form a memory that can be take a lasting form.
So there was something I read in your work, I think it was your work, about scaling down. What exactly is this?
So it started off from observations made from neurons in culture, that is lab-grown neurons in the dish. And under certain conditions, we observed that all of the synapses on a neuron could become weaker simultaneously. And this is a really interesting phenomenon, but we really didn't understand when neurons would actually do this in a living animal. And so my work tried to link this phenomenon that we'd seen in the dish with some idea that scaling down might happen during sleep. And the idea here is that synapses become stronger the longer we're awake as we encode information from our lives, and that during sleep, these synapses become weaker, resetting the synapses back to some basal level. And this will allow for a greater range of new synapse strengthening when we wake up, which would enable new learning. And part of the idea here also is that a lot of the information that we encode during the day actually does not get consolidated into long-term memory. It's trivial things like, what did I have for breakfast? Where did I park my car? And these things we remember for a few hours, but actually might become eliminated during sleep, perhaps freeing up space for important memories.
Marcos Frank.
Well, I'll begin by taking a slightly contrarian position to what Graham said. And that is that I think that while there is evidence that sleep plays an important role or a important role in some types of learning and memory, I believe that the function of sleep is actually going to involve something more basic and simple about neurons, and that the effects that we see in learning and memory are an outcome of this more fundamental thing that sleep is doing that we haven't discovered yet. So while it's true that there's evidence for weakening of synapses in sleep, as Graham has said, there's also considerable evidence that depending on the kinds of experiences that precede sleep, synapses can also get stronger or more synapses may form. So I believe where we are right now in the field is that, and particularly thanks to work from Graham, is that we're beginning to apply these really elegant tools that have been used in other areas of neuroscience to this age-old problem about sleep function. And we're beginning to understand at least some of the things that are going on one side of the story, but there's other things that are going on too. So I don't think the story is as simple as sleep is only doing these things for learning and memory. There could be other more basic functions that are being served.
So Marcos Frank, one of the things I read in relation to your work was you talking about one of the complications of even studying this phenomenon because there are so many different stages of sleep and they might mean different things. Can you talk us through some of that?
Well, one of the big problems in the field, and it's been in the field since its inception in the modern investigations of sleep, it's very difficult to disentangle other things that occur across the 24-hour day with sleep and wakefulness. So we already know that there are biological clocks in the brain and the body, and they produce rhythms in a variety of things, including things that happen in neurons that occur coincident with wake and sleep, but are independent of wake and sleep. So in many cases, if the design of the experiment's not careful enough, it's almost impossible to dissociate the effects of clocks from sleep and wake. So that's a major problem. The other problem is, as you pointed out, is that sleep is not a single brain state. In mammals, it's comprised of at least two different states. Most of the work that we've been discussing has focused on non-rapid eye movement sleep. But in mammals such as ourselves, rapid eye movement sleep comprises quite a bit of the sleep cycle. So we have a whole chunk of sleep that may be doing different things, and we can't look at one state and then assume the second state is doing exactly the same thing. And it's very hard to tease this apart.
Let's get a response. Graham Deering, what do you say to that?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with just about everything Marcos said. Indeed, it's a complex problem. One thing I'll add to the last point, differences between slow non-REM sleep and REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. Indeed, humans have quite a bit of this REM sleep, and also this breakdown of non-REM and REM changes also throughout development. So it's quite possible that the functions of sleep might also be regulated during development. That's also something that's quite an unknown area. And let me go back also to the purpose of sleep. So I started off by talking about learning and memory. I think it's fair to say that sleep is very important for learning and memory. But if we look back in evolution, we can see clearly that sleep's a conserved behavior that goes back basically to all animals. And we can look at an animal like nematode worms or fruit flies, where learning and memory maybe is not that important for their survival. And yet they show sleep-like behaviors, perhaps even in the jellyfish. So I think the function of sleep probably is some very fundamental ancient function. And during evolution, additional functions may have been added on to this sleep behavior.
And some animals sleep for much longer at certain periods of the global cycle, it seems, you know, with hibernation and that sort of a thing. Can we make sense of it that way?
Well, I think that that's sort of speaking to the point that I was sort of just trying to bring up, that sleep might be, you could almost imagine it's a Swiss Army knife that has been added to continually over evolution. It's a very good time to be doing different kind of maintenance of body system, the brain system. There might be some special metabolic things that happen during sleep. And I think that the specific aspects of learning and memory might have been sort of one of the more recent additions. Hibernation probably has a completely different type of ecological need. It's a kind of sleep-like state, but it's been adapted for some specific ecological, niches.
So when we talked about the different stages of sleep, and we know there's the REM and the non-REM, right? And I understand there's sort of a light and a deep. Is one more important than the other in human brain function? Do we know this, Marcos Frank?
Short answer is no, we don't. And I think Graham would agree with me that when it comes to sleep, despite all the advances we've made, and I say we collectively, scientists in literally the last 100 years, we don't have an answer to that basic question. When it comes to learning and memory, there's great debates over the relative roles of non-rapid eye movement or non-REM sleep and REM sleep in these processes. Some argue that REM sleep is important for this kind of memory consolidation, but other people find other findings and suggest that no, it's not. It's actually important for that kind of memory consolidation. And this debate, by the way, has been going on at least for 50 years. So since the discovery of REM sleep back in 1953, both jointly here in the United States and also in France, there has been a huge attention to rapid eye movement sleep and this idea that it's involved with dreaming, for example, which we know is not exactly true anymore. And because of that, there's been a huge interest in REM sleep and higher cognitive function in the brain. But the reality is that we still don't really know what REM sleep is doing relative to non-REM sleep. And in terms of restorative sleep, well, there's some evidence, when I say restorative, this is a whole other mystery. We don't know exactly what's being restored in the brain that makes you feel better in the morning after a good night of sleep. But in terms of restorative sleep, there is a little bit better evidence that non-REM sleep seems to be more restorative than REM. But again, there's no consensus in the field, in my opinion.
There does seem to be some evidence that sleep is vital for immune system function. Is that something that has enough evidence for us to say, yeah, that's like gravity, we know it's true?
No, in my opinion. So like with many things with sleep, there's a lot of tantalizing clues. And I think what Graham said is very important, this idea that when we look at sleep in animals such as ourselves, we're really looking at many, many things that have happened over the course of millions of years of evolution. So there may be some animal species in which there is clear connections between immune function and sleep, but it's not universally found in other species, not even within mammals, not even within primates, turns out. So while there may be some evidence in humans that immune function can be affected in different ways with sleep and sleep loss, it's not the same for other primates that have been studied, and it's not the same uniformly through rodents. So there's, unfortunately, I can't give you a simple answer to immune function and sleep. There's clearly some kind of connection. It may also reflect the fact that molecules that are involved in our immune function in the body, they have second roles inside the central nervous system that are independent in many cases of their immune function. So that's another complication, is that when we talk about immune system and sleep, what we're really talking about is immune molecules and sleep. And they may not be doing exactly the same thing inside the brain as they're doing outside the inside, in the rest of the body.
Graham Deering.
Yeah, I'll continue where Marcos left off. I think it makes a lot of sense that when you are challenged with some infection or something like that, you have inflammation in the body, and it might be that sleeping can help accelerate the recovery from this infection. And so this immune system is activated, and it might actually, some of those molecules that are fighting infection in the body might actually signal to the brain that we should increase the amount of sleep. And so it's pretty typical that when you have a cold or a flu, you feel groggy and tired. And this might be part of the way that we recover. And this sort of reverse of that, how does loss of sleep affect the immune system? It's really difficult question to answer, partly because loss of sleep is a real stress to the body. And it might be that loss of sleep secondarily causes immune changes through this stress.
Isn't it also true generally that loss of sleep, if it's continuous, also correlates with loss of memory? So then that would bring back the learning question, Graham Deering.
Yeah, I think it's clear that a great night's sleep does wonders for memory formation, and loss of sleep is disastrous. I don't know how much more I can add to that. We all know from our own experiences how low our brain seems to work after a night without sleep or poor sleep.
Are the human meta studies enough to conclude at least a relationship there? It looks like a causal relationship. Marcos Frank?
God, I'm going to be the bad guy here.
That's all right. We like bad guys.
I agree that there's probably a greater number of studies that have shown supportive evidence for the idea that sleep is important for some forms of memory formation. But again, I point out to the fact that it's really difficult to really draw a conclusion. And so you can have, let's say, a preponderance of studies that all point the same direction, but if each one is confounded by a design problem, then each one is not very, adds very little to the story. Now, there's a handful of studies, I do think, where the controls have been very good, and including for controls for biological clocks, and there still is a positive effect of sleep on some kinds of learning and memory. So I do believe that overall the evidence is pointing towards that this is certainly an outcome of whatever the function of sleep might be, that it has something to do with how the brain processes information. And this is something that's conserved also, to pick up a point that Graham was talking about, across species. All the things we've discussed to date, or right now, I should say, regarding possible sleep function, whether it's immune function or something about the body, that's true for some species, but not others. But there's one thing that you always find to be true with sleep and sleep loss, that it has an impact on the brain's ability to process information. So that tells me that something fundamental about how neurons operate is still at the heart of what sleep is for. So yeah, I it's a long way of answering your question, I guess, but I would say that our best theories right now concern the role of sleep in higher order function like learning and memory.
What is a glia cell?
So most of us are familiar with neurons. These are cells in the brain that are excitable electrically. And for the last 150 years or more, most of what we thought about how the brain operates has been through these excitable cells. But it turns out that there's more than two-thirds of the cells in the brain are glial cells, which are not excitable in the sense that neurons are. They were originally thought to be glue. The Greek word glia refers to glue, that it would hold things together in the brain. And they didn't seem to be that interesting to neuroscientists. And I think that's in part because we didn't have the tools to measure what they do. When all you have is an electrode and you measure electrical activity, you have a cell that doesn't give you anything when you poke it, then you move on to one that does. And that's kind of what's happened in the history of glial cells. In the last 25 years, our view about glial cells has changed quite dramatically. We now know that they can be partners in very complex things that the brain does, including perhaps plasticity in the brain, development of the brain for sure. And now increasingly there's some evidence that they might be important in sleep.
So they might be important in sleep, but you don't really know how.
We have some ideas. So one of the things that has been shown is that different classes of glia can, they do different things in the brain. So some of them act as the brain's immune system. Some of them are positioned to sample from the activity of many hundreds of connections between neurons at the same time. They're also positioned to sample the blood and tell what the energy levels are. They can filter things in the brain and maybe clean out various metabolic byproducts of wakefulness. So they're well positioned to do lots of important things that have been assumed to be what sleep is doing in the brain. So there's some evidence now that in fact that may be true. So we can do things to glial cells in animal models and then measure what happens to sleep and wakefulness. And when we do that, we find that if you alter certain glial signaling pathways or glial biological functions, that actually changes how animals respond to sleep loss. Other studies have shown that glia seem to be part of a cleaning system of the brain, that they can actually filter out a lot of these metabolic byproducts. This is probably one of the major findings in the last 5 years, maybe 10 years, certainly with respect to glia and sleep. But we've just really begun to explore this in detail, even though the idea that glia were involved in sleep goes back to Ramoni Cajal. So we're talking about someone that worked on one of the great, great giants of the field of neuroscience back more than 100 years ago, who was looking at these cells in the stained sections of tissue that he had at the time, drawing beautiful pictures of these cells and then imagining what they could be doing. And at that time, he proposed that they could be involved in sleep and wake. It's turning out to be right.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing mysteries of our slumber. Why do we sleep? What is its purpose? And what actually happens during sleep? So, Graham Deering, how does this connect back to what we were talking about with your research?
Right. So I think we're building up a picture that there isn't really one function of sleep. It's a time that's developed over evolution to incorporate multiple functions. And I think my work focusing on synaptic plasticity and changes of synapses is really more specific to learning and memory. How do we renew the ability to learn every day? And I love the work on the glia changes between wake and sleep. And I see that the role of the glia during sleep as a separate function of sleep, part of the maintenance of the organ, the health of the brain, maintaining the health of the brain rather than specifically for informational reasons. So I see these as parallel functions. The glia are undergoing certain processes during sleep to renew the health of the brain, and the neurons are adapting their synapses to renew their capacity for learning.
So there were a couple things I saw in your work as well, including a new protein that was discovered. What is that?
So this protein, HOMER 1A, I think it's a really interesting molecule. The work here in sleep was directly inspired from this phenomenon of homeostatic scaling down, which has been observed in cultured neurons. And so it was shown previously that this protein HOMER1A was critical for this scaling down in cultured neurons. And another thing with this protein HOMER1A is that it's strongly expressed in neurons that are that have been activated during some kind of learning process. And so what this molecule is able to do then is to link learning, gene expression during learning while we're awake, with then a restorative process during sleep. And the way I see this working is that when you are actively learning something new, the neurons that are the most engaged in this learning will express HOMER1A, and then, which results also in strengthening of those synapses in those neurons. And then when you go to sleep, the HOMER1A that was expressed while we were awake can now start this renewal process, a restorative process of scaling down, so that those neurons that were strengthened during wake can now have a chance to recover during sleep.
I found it quite fascinating that even in lab dishes, these neurons were behaving in a sleeping and waking kind of fashion. It sounds like there is at least this kind of cycle, even on the most fundamental level.
Yeah, I think that's right. And actually, I'd like to tie this into one of the previous points that we were making. So neurons in a dish can do this phenomenon of homeostatic scaling, scaling up and scaling down. And it turns out in the dish, if you just have pure neurons, it's actually very slow. It takes up to 48 hours to see this, the full effect of this scaling process. Whereas what I would propose during sleep, this could happen in a few hours. And I think that in the brain, there's a lot more intimate communication between the glial cells and the neurons. And this might actually help the neurons to accelerate this process within a few hours.
Hear, hear.
And so I guess finally what I'd want to do is kind of connect this to the, how does this affect me, right? Why can't I sleep? How is this affecting me? What does this mean for my, you know, well-being and my health and my mental health and my functional, and am I going to be able to teach my classes regularly, et cetera, et cetera? Can we respond to this in any kind of a way from what you guys have been studying, Marcos, Frank?
Well, the good news is that even without Graham and myself doing basic science in the brain, scientists have moved on anyway to find ways to understand the timing of sleep, when to go to sleep, we call sleep hygiene, all these things that can make you have better sleep and then perform better the next day. And it's kind of interesting. This is one of these rare situations where there's all these sorts of therapies and things you can do, even though we don't understand the basic process going on in the brain. It's sort of like if I told you something to eat or drink differently, but I had no idea what the stomach or intestines did. That's kind of where we are in my mind still with sleep. So I think everything that Graham has shown, for example, in this very, very important study, and the other kinds of works that have come out in the last 25 years, reinforce the idea that making sure that you have the amount of sleep that's right for you. And by the way, although we always talk about 8 hours is the amount you need, it varies tremendously from person to person. And as silly as it may sound, the best indicator of how much sleep you should get each person is how much sleep you need to feel better the next day. I mean, that's how the divide is between neuroscientists like Graham and myself and clinicians that actually advise people about how to get better sleep. But there are ways to improve your sleep, even though we don't know why you're sleeping.
You know, both studies made me question, you know, these sleep aids that people use and whether or not they actually help you get that restorative sleep or whether they disrupt it. Do we know anything about that?
Well, I'll start a little bit. Is that I think actually there's been an explosion, and Graham's, you know, younger than I am, so he's more connected to these things probably than I am, but there's a whole bunch of things that have popped up on the market right now, and all these apps to record your sleep states or your brain waves and all these other things. And I don't think a lot of them have been really well tested. So there's a lot of noise out there about what's good to use and help you sleep. I think the simplest thing is, or for example, just simple activity measures are informative for people. So if you find by wearing a device that tells you how active you've been during the day, you'll find pretty quickly whether you've not been sleeping through the night, and maybe that's contributing to things that you're doing. So I think the technology explosion with apps and so forth, it's potentially a good thing. but very few of them have been really vetted in a way that would satisfy Graham and myself.
And what about medications? Do they make a difference? Do they make things worse? Do it make things better?
Well, I'll say one thing, and I'll let Graham weigh in on this, but right now there is no pill that can be given to you that produces what we would call physiological sleep. That is sleep that is as normal and as natural as you would have without a medication, without having a problem already with insomnia or something like that. This has been the holy grail for pharmaceutical companies because insomnia is so common in industrialized countries, and yet we still don't have one. So the drugs that are available now have improved from where they used to be, where they used to be very heavy narcotic-like drugs, but they're still not producing physiological sleep. They still have a lot of problems. They do not produce the normal sleep cycles or the same kind of brain waves that you see during normal sleep. In some cases, these drugs can impair the processes that are important in learning and memory. Now, we don't know if they impair them because they're affecting the processes Graham talked about. I think that's an interesting question. Hopefully Graham can look at that. But there are clear evidence that a lot of the sleep drugs that are available can prevent memory formation. So we don't have the solution right now in the pill.
Graham Deering?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of room for improvement in the medicines used to treat sleep. I don't want to say too much for fear of pharmaceutical companies banging my door down. But it is a holy grail, as Marco said. And if I were to design a sleep drug, I would want to know what are all the on and off buttons that control sleep, and what are the restorative parts of sleep that allow us to think clearly. And I would design drugs to target those processes. But the sleep aid drugs that are used today basically were not designed with any of this information. You can almost think of them, the sleep aid properties of those drugs, it's almost a side effect of those drugs discovered pretty much by accident. And most of the sleep aid drugs that are out there basically work by suppressing the activity of the brain, causing drowsiness, but they don't really target the real processes of sleep, and especially not the restorative parts of sleep.
Earlier, we were all talking about the evolutionary process and its relationship to sleep. And I can recall an article that suggested if we went back far enough into human history, the patterns of sleeping were quite different. They may have been 4 hours, 2 hours awake, 4 hours of sleep, something more like that. And that perhaps what we've done is made an unnatural shift to this where you have to sleep, you know, a straight 7 or 8 hours. Is there any evidence to this, or is this speculation?
I'll chip in first a little bit because I reviewed a couple of grants recently on this topic. So there is evidence. So let me back up and say that the current story is that modern man lives in this completely artificial environment in which our species evolved, that we, you know, woke and slept with the rise and fall of the sun. And what we have now is, as you said, this very artificial lighting conditions in which that we are trying to impose our activity rhythms against what nature actually gave us many millions of years ago. The evidence that this could be true comes from a few studies of what are, I guess we would call non-industrialized societies or tribes, where there have been some studies looking at the sleep behaviors of populations, let's say in the jungles in Africa and South America. And these are people that had not been exposed to these sort of industrialized, I can't say for sure that they've never been touched by the industrialized world, but in some senses they have not been touched. When you look at their sleep-wake patterns, they are different to some extent from what we see, but not radically different than what we see in our societies. Now, having said that, these findings are controversial. It's not settled science by any means. So it's an open question. And there has been also people that have argued that there was a time, even in Europe, in the medieval period, where we had something that was called mid-wake, where individuals would wake up in the middle, and it was common, you know, wake up around 3 in the morning, 2 in the morning, and have a whole active period, and then go back to sleep. again, without the industrial lighting that we have today. But whether that's really true or not is it's been belied by the findings in these more non-industrialized societies. They've seen to sleep through the night, and they sleep about the same amount that we do, even in the United States or New Zealand. So it's an open question.
Graham Deering.
Well, just over Christmas, I was visiting my family in Canada, and this time of year, it's pretty dark. The sun was only coming up around 8 o'clock, and I was sleeping heroic 9-10 hours, and I basically only felt like waking up when the sun coming up. So I think we can congratulate ourselves on all kinds of industrial innovations, but nothing is more influential for our habits than the sun, I think. And so sleeping at night, I'm pretty sure, goes back to the earliest humans.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your research with us.
Thank you very much.
Marcos Frank is professor and chair at the Department of Biomedical Sciences at Washington State University, Spokane. He's the author of The Mystery of Sleep Function, The Role of Sleep in Memory Consolidation and Brain Plasticity, Dream or Reality. Graham Deering is a professor of cell biology and physiology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the co-author of Homer 1A Drives Homeostatic Scaling Down of Excitatory Synapses During Sleep. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.